have our stragglers coming, hopefully, in the next few minutes, but we're going to go through Senate Bill 1513 and then Senate Bill 1565. I may have to exit for a few minutes to testify on another bill, but we'll get started with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1513. We have two members with us today, Senator Girard and Representative Evans. If you guys could lead off. Oh, you're on 1565? Okay.
Oh, you're hearing that first?
No, we're doing 1513 first.
Okay. Do you want me to answer with them?
Yes.
Yes, that'd be great. Okay.
I get the sense that nobody wants to really speak on this.
Chair House and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Senator Fred Girard, representing Senate District 9. I'm here today to introduce Senate Bill 1513 to the committee. This is a bill that you've seen before, and we had support in this chamber. It's a very simple in design. Senate Bill 1513 allows counties to offer property tax relief to the surviving spouse of a first responder, a police officer, or fire service professional who dies in the line of duty. We're asking the police and the firemen to do more and more each year, and these people are putting their lives on the line, and I just feel very strongly that we need to do something to show our support in the Senate here. So this bill would impose a ceiling of the first $250,000 of assessed value of the homestead. The exemption would include all taxes, fees, charges, assessments imposed on the property. But it's also important to point out this is permissive. So it doesn't require the county to do that. It just allows the county to do it if it chooses to. It can put up whatever sideboard it wants. This is just giving the county the option to do this. At the suggestion of the Department of Revenue in the last session, you'll see language that will be used to create standardization application for the exemption. So there was some problems with the Department of Revenue, but those have been addressed in the bill. The bill got hung up on the other side. We'd like to send it back to them, and hopefully it'll go through this time. But again, I just think it's important that the Senate sends a message to our first responders that we're behind them.
Kevin, did you want to add?
Yeah, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to speak in favor of the bill. And I appreciate the efforts of Senator Girard and President Courtney to bring this to you again. I know that it's been their goal to make sure this is a process that works. From a law enforcement perspective, where, as Senator Girard mentioned, the work of police officers and firefighters is increasingly complex. For police officers, increasingly dangerous as well, because of the environment we're in, and where the public environment is more and more difficult. This kind of bill sends a message to the law enforcement officers and their families, fire professionals and their families, that they are supported, and I think it's critically important. As Senator Girard mentioned, it is an optional for the counties. I know that if there's objections with how this is structured, the goal is to figure out how to make it work, and I think they've done a good job of trying to adjust based on some of the concerns that were expressed last time. So we fully support the bill and appreciate your consideration today. This would send a great message to law enforcement, fire professionals, and their families.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take some questions if there are any. I'm going to apologize and leave for 5 minutes and come back, and I'm fully supportive.
So thank you.
I'm late. Did you already speak, Senator?
I did.
You did. And you had great things to say?
I did.
Okay. Questions? Senator?
Thank you. You know, my district doesn't seem to do things like the rest of the state. So we don't have fire departments in the rural areas. We have a private fire company. And with those people, they do the same job. Would they fall under this?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. I don't think so. But
maybe we need to do an amendment because they do the same exact job.
Well, that would, but it would be up to the. We could be happy to amend it, but I. It would still be up to the county
sure.
as to if that would be something that they would want to do. They're not employees of the county.
No.
And so that would probably exempt them out.
Chair Boquist.
Staff has a comment to that.
Yeah, I can jump in there, Senator. It does tie in in the language to the definition. It looks like an ORS 181A 355, excuse me, which for the fire service professional does mean a paid or volunteer firefighter. And it goes on, an officer or a member of the public or private fire protection agency that is engaged primarily in fire investigation, prevention, safety, fire control, and suppression. So the big, I guess, there near the end of the explanation, the ORS, is fire service professional does not mean forest fire protection agency personnel. So that's the one that is not included there.
But it did say public and private.
It does have public or private fire protection, yeah.
But it excludes forest.
Forest is excluded, yes.
So, yes, Senator, you do not need to declare conflict of interest.
I was just saying, but we do have private fire companies instead of rural fire districts, so it sounds like that they would be included. Okay, great.
Senator Riley, question or anything? You had a comment additional, Mr.
Nope,
Campbell?
That was it. That was answered. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll move to the next panel. I think Wendy Johnson,
Thank
League
you.
Of Oregon Cities.
Thanks, Fred.
Are you going to talk on this bill? Okay. Come on, League. Come on, Wendy.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. It's hard to be against folks that have given their lives, and so it's awkward for me to get up here and say that we oppose the bill. But we do for some principles that are longstanding. There are exemptions given for military, active military, and veterans, and this exemption is far and away much higher than those and are not consistent. There's also no need-based. If you look at the disabled veterans or the other provision, there's got to be a need, and there's no nexus here. There could have been several million-dollar policy given to the family, and that's not taken into account. So, for example, the veterans one is for a surviving spouse or a disabled veteran is $23,000. It's just under that. It's cost of living kind of thing, so it keeps changing, but it's just under $23,000. The one for active duty military residents is just under $79,000. So this one's at $250,000. So there's no need, and there's you know, need-based look, and there's no nexus to how these other benefits are given. next, this one says it's a local option. We're happy with local option, except this one is a local option that the county decides only. So it could be that the person is serving in one county and lives in a totally different county, and so there's no nexus between, you know, the homestead. You could be working for the Clackamas County, and then your house is in Multnomah County in Portland, and so this binds all taxing districts. That's in line 15 of the first page of the bill. So schools, we're not getting any money from schools with this, the way it works, if the county decides to give up the exemption. So you'll see lots of bills this session about having to have a percentage of the taxing districts agree to give an exemption. This one does not have that. The county decides for everybody, even if the county has no detriment at all because the house isn't in that county. The bill is improved from last session. Last session there was Senate Bill 197 and Senate Bill 865. And those we opposed as well. And they've improved some of the application procedure so it could actually work better, but it still has these fundamental policy problems. I think those are my main issues and be happy to answer any questions.
Please, Senator.
Thank you, Vice Chair. And you might not be able to answer this. It might have to come from staff, but does the person have to be killed in the line of duty or?
Yes.
They do
yes.
have to be killed yes. in the line of duty. Okay.
So this is a benefit for the spouse. Correct.
Okay.
And so it did take out the, it was married. They could have been remarried last time, and that issue was fixed. So that's an improvement upon it. Okay. But it doesn't have anything to do with whether that person has the finances and needs this exemption, essentially.
Okay. So just so I, clarity. Since the chair is not here, and despite you know the way it looks, I'm not the chair. Okay, the number of individuals, police officers killed in the line of duty is 70 since 1995. Unless I got to do my math here, somebody help me. 20 years, yeah, roughly 20 years, And that's 25 police officers and 30 fire professionals in that same time frame. So is it clear to me that the cities, none of the cities of the 200 some cities in the league, you know, would think this is a good idea? Or is this just the principal thing of if we're going to do it, we need to do it a better way?
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, it's the principle of it. I didn't have those numbers either to know how many were really affected. I mean, it's prospective, so, you know, I don't want a mass casualty, you know, in the future either, but you're right, and it doesn't affect a lot of people, but we're so careful on exemptions to make sure there's a nexus between giving up a huge, you know, revenue for, could be for 40 years on a $250,000. I mean, that's a long time for not showing any need. And so we just, as a principal, we have a you know, problem with that. But specific cities, no, they haven't weighed in on each one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Jody Wisner.
Good morning, Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee. So we oppose this tax break, too. We oppose it because while we sympathize with these spouses, that the situation is such that we're not funding the basic needs of our state, and we don't really have extra money. There's nothing wrong with giving people extra money, which this would do, and it would be grand to give the same benefit to the spouses of people who are killed by police officers or who die in fires because they weren't saved by firefighters. I mean, there's a lot of people at risk in this state, but to just do this when we're then not going to have the money that we would otherwise have to educate their children doesn't really make sense. And we are short of money. Our property taxes in Oregon are average in the country. And without a sales tax, they should probably be higher than average in order to meet our needs. This would just be another way to reduce our property tax revenue. Given our dreadful graduation rates, our high class sizes, our short school year, it doesn't seem prudent to be making a decision like this. If we want Oregon children, including the children of these families, to benefit in this state, it would make sense to at least have an amendment to the bill that excludes from the exemption education dollars so that community colleges, ESDs, and K-12 funding across the state is not impacted by a local decision. There are lots of tax breaks that we have where we could make that change since local people are making decisions that actually affect the ability to pay for education across the state. So with all due respect to firefighters and police officers and their families, we urge you to either oppose this bill or to offer an amendment that excludes education dollars from the abatement. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Jody. I appreciate it very much. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on 1513? I think we heard it has an impact on counties, on education places. I don't see the OEA or the School Board Association or the Associated Oregon Counties. I don't see anybody. Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 1513. Colleagues, we will probably take that up in some form at a later point, I'm assuming, at the discretion of the chair. With that, we're going to move on to the agenda and open a public hearing only on SB 1565. If you would please, Kyle, and this is your bill too.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, 1565 may sound somewhat familiar to some of the committee members. It in some ways is a continuation of Senate Bill 938 that was up during the 15 session. There have been some tweaks to it, but I'll try to step through it again. This is a new property tax exemption. And there's quite a bit to it, so I'll try to step through it as best I can. And then I also have a couple examples that I can go through that are up in OLIS just to hopefully provide context. So what the measure would do, it allows a county or a city by ordinance or resolution to provide a property tax exemption or deferral for newly constructed or installed industrial improvements that have a cost of initial investment of at least $1 million. It requires the qualified property be owned or leased by the applicant and used through the final year of the exemption for the purpose and at the location identified in the application. The property
is eligible only if its qualified property was first placed in service after the ordinance or resolution is adopted and if the first assessment year corresponds to the assessment year to which the application is filed. And what that means is more or less there is no retroactivity. That is one thing that was in 938 that's not in 1565 is the property has to be new, has to come on the roll after the ordinance or resolution, and it can't step into the exemption. The way the exemption works is it's, again, this is it is allowed to the county or city by ordinance or resolution, but there is standard language in SB 1565. The way the standard language works is the exemption is, it's a phase-out exemption. So in year one, it'd be 100% exempt. The new property would be 100% exempt. In year two, it'd be 80%. Year three, 60%. Year four, if I did that right, 20%, and then year, or excuse me, 40% in year four, 20% in year five, and then year six, there is no longer, no exemption. So it becomes fully taxable at that point. So it's a phase out of the exemption, or in the inverse, it's a phase in of tax liability. Now, the counties or cities do have the authority to deviate from that language, but that is the standard language. So as I said, yeah, the counties, the county or a city, through their ordinance or resolution, can adjust the number of years the exemption is available. So they can, it has to be a minimum of 3 years, but the exemption, the city or the county can decide whether or not to have, add years four or five. And they can also adjust the minimum threshold. So that $1 million, the city or county could up that and say, we only want properties over $10 million or so to qualify. The city or the counties are allowed to amend or terminate the ordinance or resolution. So they can have one in place for 1 year, and then a year later, they can put in a new ordinance or resolution. And another takeaway, and that's different from 938 and 1565, is that the city or the county may use a deferral. So it'd follow the same schedule and everything as the exemption, but it'd be a deferral. Let's see if I covered everything. There is a sunset on the provision for the deferral or the exemption, January 2nd, 2027. Of course, anything that's receiving the exemption and still has time left on it would continue to do so past the sunset. And it takes effect 91st day following sine die. And then briefly, just to, I guess, draw your attention to the examples that are up on OLIS. Don't necessarily have to step through them. I'll just try to step through one, but it does explain in a few different ways, depending upon the depreciation of the property, what the exemption would look like. We can try to get that up on the larger screen, but it does base it on the standard language too of the 100%, the 80%, the 60%, and so forth. So I've laid out a few different ones depending upon, like I said, the depreciating, whether it's depreciating, or depreciating rather rapidly. And maybe the takeaway there is really the percent down at the bottom, the last row there, you can see the percent of RMV exempt. You can get a sense of what the exemption would offer to the new property. So while it is set up at 100, 80, 60, because the exemption is based upon the cost of investment of the property and how that intertwines with the real market value, the actual exemption would still be around the 180, 60%, but it could fluctuate a bit. Again, this is a new exemption. There's a lot in there, so that's, I guess, my best attempt to trying to summarize the main points.
Thank you, Colin. Colleagues, you remember, I think we passed a version of this out across the Senate floor previously and got to the House and ran out of time in a variety of regions. And, Kyle, could you just briefly walk through from the staff how much time has been spent on this and the various players that have been involved have been asked for input, and we've tried to, you know, get that input. If you could just kind of run down that list, because you have spent an inordinate amount of staff time on this.
Yes, Senator. This is one, yeah, we've been working on fairly continually throughout, I'd say, the interim. And I can speak for myself, and in some cases, legislative council as well has discussed with a number of people, different parties, both on industry and administrative side, to try to get the main points in there, and then also to make it work in the way that people think it will work administratively. Maybe not to the exactly the way everybody wants it, right, of course, because that's how a bill's made, but trying to get the language right so it does do what it's intended to do.
Thank you. And we have a long list of people. Representative Evans is here, and I see two people are signed up together, and I have two empty sheets. So, Mr. Cross, Mr. Bruneau, if you'd make your way up. Representative If you would, please. Thank you.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I am Paul Evans, representing House District 20, which along with the Vice Chair covers parts of Polk County and Marion County, although his district obviously is much larger than mine. Really, my job today is to talk about two or three things, the 30,000-foot level of why I think this bill is not only ready for prime time, but in fact something that is essential. And here's the spiel. Much of this session, and in fact some of last session, and I assume sessions to come, will be about how we find a way to build a sustainable middle-class economy in the 21st century. At the end of the day, that is in fact what a lot of the fights and a lot of the discussions are about. This particular bill is one of those that really shouldn't have a lot of controversy because it actually does all the things we always say we want to do, providing more tools in the toolkit, providing for local options for tailoring, incentives for folks that want to invest and build value added to the properties that, again, will lead into more jobs, production, and sales. This is one of those things I think that at the end of the day, when the history is written in the February session, if we get this passed, we will be very proud of because it actually makes sense. To me, this is about jobs, it's about helping small business, and most importantly, especially with the folks that are sitting up here with me today that have done yeoman's work on that, is about building a brand for Oregon in many ways. Products that are built here, grown here, made here, and then sold across the world bring people back to come to Oregon to buy more and to buy more and to stimulate more jobs. A little bit later, I think you're going to hear about a possible amendment. The possible amendment has to do with a different way of feathering in the taxing. Bottom line is, however, is the most effective way to do that that doesn't cause too much trouble for the locals and the actual math of getting it done that is an incentive large enough to help folks want to invest and put more value into the foundation of the taxable base is a net win for us. So I strongly urge passing this bill again, which you did once before, and hopefully sending a signal to the rest of the legislature that this is exactly the kind of bill we should be moving forward to helping to build that 21st century economy. So I'm going to stop right there and say thank you very much for the opportunity to co-chief sponsor with this bill with the vice chair of this committee, and strongly urge your support because, again, this is a signal, the right kind of incentives, and hopefully something that we look back on as a model for other things to come.
Mr. Committee Vice Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of Willamette Valley Vineyards. I would like to express our appreciation during the interim to Senator Boquist and to Kyle Easton for trying to reach out to some of the other stakeholders who worked on Senate Bill 938 and who I think contributed a lot to improve the concept. And I'll ask Jim Bruneau, the founder and chief executive of Willamette Valley Vineyards, to talk a little bit about what the benefits are to passing this bill.
Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the founder and CEO of Willamette Valley Vineyards, located just south of Salem, with vineyards and operations throughout rural Oregon. I want to thank you for all the time that you've invested in this. Your time, I believe, is well spent. As you know, there's a significant problem in rural Oregon, especially in agricultural regions, where unemployment is high, wages are low, opportunity is low, even values are declining. What we're looking for is a tool to incent investment and the growth of the capital base and opportunities that exist in these areas. There is an opportunity to do that. As has been mentioned, there is a change that's occurring in agriculture where there's more value-added opportunities. So there is an opportunity for us to build this capital base if we can provide opportunities and incentives to do that in rural Oregon. The challenge we're facing as business owners is when we make these capital investments, right when we make them, we're faced with very high property tax bills before these capital investments can make a profit to pay those expenses. And so what this allows us to do is to make those capital investments knowing that we can get those capital assets up and working over a period of time to where they can cover those tax expenses. And so this is a way of encouraging that development that either wouldn't occur or would occur on a smaller scale with less opportunity for employment. So I appreciate very much your attention to this. Now, I know that the assessors have looked at this and tried to figure out a way to make this more practical in how in implementation, and I encourage them to look at how to do that, and I think they've got some good ideas. What we're looking for is we're looking for a tool for the counties to encourage development, and we're looking for a plan that is certain for our investment so that we can get these capital assets whatever it's capital construction of various kinds up and on its feet and making money so we can pay the taxes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's go down our list here. I will call up Wendy Johnson and Dan Jarman.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Senators, we support this bill and have worked with Senator Boquist all interim on this bill. It's been a complex area to try to get right, and I understand that we still don't have it quite right according to the assessors, but we want to work to get this done. We have lots of tools now. We have the E-Zone, we have the SIP program, and we have, like, yesterday the industrial property, or excuse me, the food processing one. We don't have a tool, though, for other products, unless you hit that one little group of food processors, you know, in that list, or you happen to be in E-Zone, we don't have another tool for other products. And if a company wants to expand or a new one come, we just don't have a tool. And this one will provide that tool for industrial property. It's narrowed. You've got to have an investment of at least $1 million. So that's putting us in the category of industrial property that's state assessed. And according to the Department of Revenue, we have less than 2,000 of those properties. So we know what we're dealing with, and this bill provides a local option. And unlike the previous bill today, this one is a true local option. The city or county gets to decide if they're going to do this program, and they don't bind the other taxing districts unless they get at least 51%. It's just going to be the city or county that would be giving the tax benefit. So it addresses those issues. We need the tool. It is a local option. It also permits us to add additional requirements. In section 1.2b, it provides that the ordinance or resolution that the city or county adopts can add other things. We talked about adding, you know, a jobs requirement or something like some of the other programs, but the number of jobs in one part of the state and how many that, if it's a good enough benefit, is totally different in another part of the state. And so we're leaving it to the locals to decide if they want additional sideboards on this exemption before they grant it. And we think that's important. It's for 5 years. That's the typical number for the E-Zones and yesterday's food processing one. 5 years is typical. That helps with the problem of how expensive some of this equipment is. But it gets it back on the tax rolls after 5 years, so it's an appropriate length. Let me see. I think those are the main things. We are in competition with lots of other states, and we just need more tools. This is narrow enough that we think it will work. It can work well, and it gives us flexibility. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go to Dan Jarman first.
Dan Jarman here this morning representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. The Oregon Wine Growers very much support this legislation and want to thank Jim Bruneau and Willamette Valley Vineyards for bringing this to the legislature again. Willamette Valley Vineyards is a very important member to the Oregon wine industry. Some of you may or may not know that you can really trace the promotion and the growth of the Oregon wine industry to policies here at the legislature. And many of those, if not most of those policies, have been developed and pushed by Jim Bruneau and the Willamette Valley Vineyards. So really have a great deal of appreciation for what he's done to help bring our industry along. We now have 700 wineries in the state of Oregon. But at the same time, most of those are small wineries. 70% or so produce 5,000 cases of wine a year or less. And so this is an important tool for many of sort of the bigger wineries. But we think over time, as some of the smaller wineries grow and grow into it, they'll be able to access this, which we think is very important. I mean, that's what our industry is like. You know, it's a long-term game, from planting vineyards and seeing grapes grow to harvesting, to crush, to fermentation and bottling. That's a long time period. So Jim's comments about needing sort of time to be able to sort of accept the tax consequences is very important for us. And so as some of these smaller wineries build up their customer loyalty, build up their brands over time, they're going to be big enough to access this, which we think is going to be very important for the future growth of the industry. So all that to say, we are in great support for this. Thank Willamette Valley for bringing it along, and hopefully the committee will again pass it. One more thing to add. I want to thank Senator Boquist, too, for bringing down that threshold. The last legislation had a $2 million threshold. We think the $1 million level is, again, the right area to for some of our wineries over time to get to that. So thank you very much for accommodating that request. We appreciate it.
Do we have any questions? We either are two witnesses here. All right. Thank you both. Representative Davis has joined us on Senate Bill 1565.
Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Senators. I am State Representative John Davis from House District 26, the fighting 26th. I represent Wilsonville, Sherwood, King City, Hillsboro, Beaverton, Tigard, Alloa, and a bunch of unincorporated Washington and Clackamas County. It's great to be here from the House of Representatives before Senators to express my strong support for 1565. Apologies for being late. It's my four-year-old son's birthday, so I had to get him up and wish him happy birthday and give him a couple gifts this morning. I wanted to just briefly, I know you've heard testimony already in support, and this bill obviously in a very similar form already received substantial support from the Senate in the 2015 session. But I just wanted to add a little color to why I was enthusiastic when the idea came back this session. And if you look at my district, which is a suburban district, but that also includes a bunch of rural area, unincorporated area, we're sort of in the donut hole as it comes to economic development. We are, frankly, above the thresholds that would qualify most of the area for any E-zone or economic development zone. We have SIP zones in other parts of Hillsborough and Washington County, but not in my district. And so there is a gap that's been expressed to me by a number of my cities and my counties saying that they lack the tools they feel to bring and encourage and incentivize good, industrial, great-paying jobs that we want to encourage in the state. And when I saw this opportunity, I really felt as though it could help serve as a tool to my local governments to be able to provide and tailor and custom tailor an incentive for whether it be Wilsonville or Hillsborough or Sherwood or Clackamas County or Washington County that could work in each of their particular circumstances. I like the fact that this provides a template but doesn't prescribe precisely what every jurisdiction must do and really adds one of the proverbial tools in the toolkits for the area. Wilsonville has been successful at utilizing, for example, its urban renewal zones and just a couple of the tools it does have, as limited as they are, and that has been a successful program. But it's just been continually expressed to me that my local governing bodies don't have an opportunity in the same way as we see with the large strategic investment program or with other communities and E-zones. So I just wanted to give a little color to why I'm supportive of this bill, and thank you very much for your time.
Question, Senator Boquist?
Thank you. I mean, you weren't here. Representative Evans expressed his position on this, but I'm just curious to ask you from, you're like me, kind of all over the place. You have a whole handful of counties that are out there. The county Association of Oregon Counties, at the 11th hour after a year of discussions, and the assessors at the 11th hour, specifically middle of last week, have decided that one size fits all again, and that we should just have one plan, one size fits all across the entire state. And you just mentioned the key was flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are you in agreement that, you know, we should be either flexible or we should just have one size fits all?
Well, thank you to the chair. Thank you, Senator Boqvist. I'll just tell you what's been expressed to me by county commissioners and by my city councilors, which is they'd like to have an opportunity to custom and tailor fit what works for Wilsonville or Sherwood or Clackamas County or Washington County. And to me, that means something might look very different in Wilsonville Incorporated versus a rural part of Washington County. So I think the tailor-made approach is attractive in this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Asina Squires.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 taxing districts in the state, water, sewer, fire, rural protection districts. Happy to have the opportunity to testify on this bill, a much improved bill from Senate Bill 938 from last legislative session. Appreciate the allowances that Senator Boqvist has given in the bill for the 51% of the taxing districts to concur. One small ticky-tack item that we would ask you to entertain is increasing that threshold to 75% threshold. Representative Davis, actually, since he already left, has a bill coming over on brownfields that would have that that threshold set at 75% from the House Revenue Committee. So I assume that you'll get that over here shortly. The concern from special districts, and it's not a large one, so we would be fine with the 51%, but if you standardizing that to 75% from our perspective would be better for us. We have, I can see a scenario where it's a city and a county and obviously a rural fire protection district in Washington County, and that a city or county could choose to grant that tax exemption, and we wouldn't reach that 51% threshold with the amount of property tax authority that just a fire district has, or if it was just the city or the county. So we would encourage all local governments to collaborate when these exemptions are granted, and hope that that is the case, and think that if the threshold is set a little higher, that everyone will have a seat at that table. We have not experienced scenarios where local, where there have been exemptions and the ability to provide exemptions where local governments have not all agreed to grant the exemption. We don't typically see special districts choosing not to grant the exemption, but we believe that it will encourage and incent local governments to work better together in an effort to make sure that their property tax revenues are being exempted equally.
Thank you, Senator Boqvist.
Okay, thank you.
Could I bring up Douglas Schmidt, John Phillips, and Mark Garst as a panel? Mr. Phillips, I know you have a different hat these days, so I know you've done some work on this too, so why don't you start?
Yes, I do, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Phillips, and I'm with the Association of Oregon County Assessors, and we're here to talk about this bill and our position on it, which hasn't changed from last session. The bill itself presents a lot of opportunity for local control. You've heard that. A lot of variability. Innumerable options for cities or county commissioners to make decisions about how it should be shaped or formed, which is wonderful for flexibility and horrible for a tax administrator to just sort of figure out, okay, I've got 17 to 20 cities in my county, let's say, in Clackamas, and for example, and I've got maybe four or five different ways each one wants to do it, and then they can each amend the way they're doing it by the percentages in future years for future projects. So it creates creates a lot of programs out of one what could be a more simple program. We think we understand what was intended last session. We think basically the intent is the same, and that is to provide industries, local industries, with opportunities to get their machinery and equipment and buildings up and running and getting a return coming on that, for example, like the Willamette Vineyards tasting room situation. And so what we said is, well, we we know the system better maybe than anybody else, and so we'll propose an alternative. And so we have an alternative. You don't have it in front of you yet because it's still in the works, but it would offer, and I don't know how much you want me to talk about it, but it would offer an almost equal opportunity and yet keep the cities with options to control the amount of loss of revenue, the cities and county commissioners, to control the amount of loss of revenue that they would experience. And that does that by allowing a 100% exemption in year one, fully taxable in year two, 100% exemption in year three, and the city or county commission could decide to opt for the fifth year to be 100% exempt too. So that way they could potentially get a 1, 3, and 5, 3 years worth of 100% exemption. We've talked with a lot of people about that, including Senator Boqvist and Senator Haas and the proponents, and we think it's a solution that's workable. We think it still provides the incentive, and it's similar to what you have for what was mentioned, food processor exemption, enterprise zone exemption, and the majority of exemptions are 100%. And that way the assessor doesn't have to track, okay, which percentage is it this year for this project, for this property, and there may be other projects on the same business at running at different percentages. So we think it's a solution that gets the bill moving forward and everybody standing behind it. So we would propose that. The deferral piece, not only is the exemption a new program, but it's a program that we could administer if it was consistent. But the deferral piece at the Section 3 of the bill creates an entirely new process that's, I would say, unprecedented. We do not have a deferral program in Oregon, in my opinion. So the assessors are not programmed. They don't have the software, nor is the Department of Revenue, I don't believe, prepared to run a deferral program. You know about the senior deferral program. Truly, that's not a deferral program because the taxes are paid on that. The county gets the money. The state pays that. So there's no real deferral of taxes. In this case, it would be a deferral of taxes. And, of course, the tax lien would then become the superior lien on the account. All of the other liens, if there's a mortgage lien or a lender lien, they would become subordinate. So it creates some complexities that we don't currently have going on in any other program. We would recommend that the deferral piece go away. We've talked with various people, including proponents, and said, do you think anybody is even interested in this? And we've not yet heard anybody that has shown any interest. So it could be something down the road you could consider if there's an outcry or some kind of call for that. But at this point, we think the bill should move forward with a 100% exemption in the years I mentioned and the deferral piece missing. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We'll go through the whole panel here first.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm here to testify today on the bill as also a representative of the Assessors Association. Our concerns for this bill have been expressed over the year, and including last session, and I want to thank the stakeholders in this bill, including Senator Boqvist, for looking at some changes, some tweaks that will help us administer it even better. And that is the only reason I'm here. The policy, economic development, yes, we need that. It's just being able to administer this in a fair and equitable, easy manner. John has talked about an amendment, 100% exemption. One of the issues we had and we still have is if a single jurisdiction is able to create an exemption, it requires the counties to create tax code areas for that specific asset, that $1 million asset. We would have to create a new tax code area that would exempt the city or the county from that tax rate so that we could administer that. And then when that exemption came off, we'd have to move that property back into that tax code that has all of the districts within that tax code area. So, again, it's just some additional work that the counties have to do. If it was an all districts within that jurisdiction's area were exempt, then it would be like any other exemption that's 100% And it's much easier to administer that way. No new tax code areas. So that's one of the things I would ask the committee to consider, is to amend that. I have some examples that are very complex. I think Senator Boquist had asked for just a breakdown of how the proposals that the assessors were bringing forward would impact the tax savings. And surprisingly, it's not a large difference. The graduated step down of an asset, the amount of the tax savings is very similar to the amount of the tax savings if we did a alternating 3-year exemption, or if we did a exemption for the first 3 years. I don't know that I can explain those graphs in detail right now, but Senator, if you want, I can talk to you about them later. But I believe that they do show that the benefits of getting away from a step down over a period of 5 years, the tax savings would be very similar to the other proposals that we have made.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. So we're neutral on the bill, and I would just echo some of the statements that have been previously made. We appreciate that some of the comments that we made on Senate Bill 938 have made their way into the bill, and we really appreciate the Senator Boquist and the bill proponents being willing to work with us. With that said, we do still have some concerns. I think that the point's been adequately made about, you know, how this will allow local jurisdictions to create just a multitude of different programs. I would just note that at the Department of Revenue, we appraise property statewide, and so we will have to be familiar with each and every one of these programs, most likely. The progressively decreasing percentage of exemption would be especially difficult for us to administer, just because we would have to manually track every single account to kind of keep track of that. And we assume that property will be coming in multiple years, and so you'd have a situation where some property in the account is at 100% exempt, other properties at 60% exempt. Some of it may be under the city exemption, some under a county exemption, and it would just be quite tricky. We don't know how much work it would be, because we don't know how many jurisdictions will actually be adopting these ordinances, but the more successful that the program is, the more work that it would generate for our staff. Exemptions are typically applied at the real market value level. The only exemption that I'm aware of that's applied at the assessed value level is actually the exemption for disabled veterans, the homestead exemption that was mentioned in the context of the last bill. Having it exempted at the AV level creates some added complexities. We need to do additional tests to make sure that the value doesn't start to dip into other property, and so that also just adds a little bit more complexity. There's a provision in the bill to avoid stacking exemptions, which obviously that's a great idea. It's a little tricky for us to know if a piece of property is bought used, whether or not that property might have received an exemption at a different facility. And then once the property sells, maybe to another user, we don't really have a way of tracking in the future that property wouldn't receive some other exemption. So that would be a little bit difficult for us to administer. I'd echo the concerns on the deferral piece. That is a little hard. Maybe it's a lack of imagination. It's a little hard for us to wrap our heads around. And we would just say that while it would be a very rare situation, we do have some rapidly depreciating equipment that is, you know, like, say, electronics manufacturing equipment. It's effectively obsolete after 5 years. And so you might put some taxpayers in a weird position where the amount of taxes that they owe is near what the equipment's worth. Again, that's rare. And certainly not for, like, food processing equipment. That equipment has a long life. That would never happen. But on, you know, electronics manufacturing in particular, we could see that situation. You know, the discussion about local control is definitely, I mean, it's a good discussion to have. And we're sympathetic to the idea that people want to be able to craft their own exemptions. But I think that you all definitely know how complex it is to craft these legislation. And so with these ordinances, I just say that some of them are going to be written better than others, and we're not looking at any of them right now. So it's hard for us to say any concerns that we might have with sideboards, with the criteria, the way they're set. We just don't really know. And so, you know, certainly our property tax system lacks some uniformity thanks to Measure 50. I mean, and there are other examples like the Enterprise Zone where some areas you can get a benefit that you can't get in other areas. So I'm not saying it's unprecedented, but this would just create a net increase in the level of or in the lack of uniformity. And so we typically like to try and, I mean, maybe it's just for ease of administration. Maybe we're only thinking about ourselves, but we do like to try and keep things kind of in a cohesive manner statewide. So those are my comments.
Cohesive is good. Senator
Thank you. I do have a question to Doug because she's the smart guy in the room here. And I want to preface this so everybody's on the same streaming. Mr. Phillips did mention, you know, we know the system, so on and so forth. So here's my perspective, and I think at least, you know, I don't know, 28 members of the Senate's perspective in the last session. The system's broken, just so everybody's clear here. Let's just stop missing words here. We have seven counties in crisis. We have two counties, one in southwest Oregon and one in eastern Oregon. It's one step short of armed insurrection because of the economy is just in the toilet. And Doug, you and I both live in Dallas. All you got to do is go down the main street, Guys Harbor. How long have we, I mean, Preggets or may or may not come out the new building because there's power issues now for the new developer there. We have Warehouse or Willamette building that's been sitting there until the next Superfund. I mean, we got to think outside of the box, and we got to have some sort of flexibility. And I really appreciate your format here, because my suggestion, if you don't know when they came, I said, hey, look, Doug's done all the work here. We just share it with DOR and all the counties, and now we have a model of how to figure out this. Okay, so you and I both have to live in the real world out in our districts, because you're an elected official. I'm an elected official. I mean, how do we create flexibility? Because, I mean, it's a basket case in the rural portions of Polk County just across the river. You know what it was to get a public safety levy. So I don't know. I'm looking for, you know, one size does not fit all, because if it did, we'd all be like Portland, and we wouldn't have this discussion, because Portland is growing, and you and I are sinking into dismal mud.
Chair Haas has members of the committee, Senator Boquist. You've asked some very difficult questions. Assessors are, we look at how easy is something to administer. Because, again, like everybody else, with reduced budgets, we have reduced staff. Again, we are not opposed to economic development. And the amendments that have been made, the changes that have been made to this bill, help us administer this bill much easier, better than the bill that was introduced last session. You know, I can't answer. How do we get flexibility and still have ease of administration? I can't answer that question. Sorry.
Well, Mr. Phillips wants to jump in. So
if I might, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist.
Yes.
Our first idea, it's not before you, but I'll be happy to offer it right now. And I think it answers your question directly. And that is that, you know, something that creates a lot of variability and a lot of options creates more government, because I know at least two counties, Washington and Multnomah, have hired new exemption staff just to handle new exemptions, additional staff that they haven't had to in the past because it's building. And so in order to say, okay, rather than create more government, you could look at a chart of what's required under this bill, or you could say to get the same result, you could have the city simply make a decision that they're going to pass a resolution allowing for exemptions of new development, ask the assessor on various projects for which they've received applications, what was the tax for this year, and cut them a check. Simple as that. Because if the city is opting to have the program, they're opting to have their tax levy against this property exempt, and they're opting the number of years, then they know exactly what the cost is. In these cases, you could basically take the county, the city's rate times the total taxes available. It might be an $850 check, maybe a $1,000 check. They just write the check, and then you completely avoid messing with the whole property tax system, and it makes less government and is more direct and is extremely flexible.
Senator, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, that was one of the alternatives that we proposed. That instead of having this be part of an exemption or deferral process, that in fact my administrator said, well, why don't we just write them a check out of the economic development funds that we get from lottery. And there's that option. And that way it takes out all the calculations. The property is held whole. We value it as a taxable property, but then after the taxes are paid, the jurisdiction notifies us of the value of that asset, and a check is cut.
So,
and
just a grant rather than an exemption is really what you're talking about.
It would be more in line maybe with an economic development side of things than an exemption program. It was an option that we proposed, but it was so far out that we tried to stay in line with what how the bill was written. But that is an option. Either they pay out of their general funds or it comes out of economic development funds, with the understanding that they may need a few more economic development funds to the counties.
We've had similar discussions about tax credits. Instead of going through the thing, just have the state write a check to the farmers or whoever.
But this, Senator Hass, this would keep it at the local level. I mean, they would have control over how they approved the economic development program, and there would not be any issue with the clawback because the taxes would be paid before they would get the reimbursement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. That solution is one that I've been pushing for. Indirect expenditures are much more difficult to administer. They tie down future as opposed to what we can currently afford. I much prefer direct expenditures, and this solution is good. It doesn't have anything to do with this bill, however. And so that's just a comment for future reference.
Senator Bartschuh.
Your alternative solution here, the only thing that I'm concerned about is picking winners and losers. You know, we have to be really careful because taxation needs to be equitable to everybody. And if you give cities or counties the ability to maybe whose friend is on the city council or whose friend is the commissioner, and we start giving the ability to pick winner, I'm a little bit concerned with that.
Sure.
Senator Bocas.
I just want to remind everybody, including in the audience, that this is a permissive bill. So it doesn't create anything at any county, unless the county or the city, so on and so forth, desires for it. And I do realize that, you know, in places, because it was raised that in places, you know, the county commissioners, well, used to have a county where the county commissioners aren't speaking terms with the mayors. But generally speaking, unless I'm missing something here, Doug, and this question's for you, is that you have a pretty good working relationship with our three county commissioners in Polk County, right? When they come up with some stupid idea, last time I checked, you're pretty good at going up and saying, this is really a stupid idea. Have you thought about doing this better? I mean, there's that relationship between the, at least in the elected places, where there's this cooperation in which, you know, local control, even in this, has a fact of your ability to go up to the county commissioners as an elected official and say, have you really thought this thing through?
Senator Hass, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, that is true. I have a very good relationship with our commissioners. That's not true in every county. But again, I think if they saw that this was an economic tool that they could bring industry or expand industry, and I had to expand additional effort to administer it, they would probably, again, I'm speaking for them, but I would think they would want to bring that industry in, even though I told them that this would require additional work. And that's their purview under this bill. I can see where jurisdictions would want to promote economic development any way they can. Yeah. We're just looking to promote ease of administration in any way we can.
Right. We might have gotten to the low-hanging fruit already, though. That's the problem. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, gentlemen, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. More Cummings. Jody Weiser.
Okay.
Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you, Senator Hass, and members of the committee. So my comment's pretty much like last time. Education dollars are a real problem. People locate and expand their businesses where they think their kids and their employees' kids are going to be well educated. And we actually are branded as one of the states with the lowest taxes for businesses, but also one of the states for the lowest quality of education. And keeping doing things for businesses without reversing the education the downward slope of our education system is just not a prudent idea. One of the things that bothers me about this bill is that when we created enterprise zones years ago, the idea was that they were supposed to serve districts that had areas that had problems in attracting business. And now you're actually considering legislation that a local jurisdiction could choose to not even require the same kinds of things that we require of a business in an enterprise zone. They have to increase their employment. But there's nothing in this bill that requires an increase in employment. And so while I can easily understand why business owners would like this, it's hard to understand the public good, because many of these businesses are going to buy that equipment because they need it, whether they have a tax break or not. And the one business community that's been speaking to you is the wine industry, which is thriving in the state. But if you do this, all sorts of other industries are going to get the benefit. I think of the food processing exemption we made last year. We were talking about businesses in Eastern Oregon, but Dave's Bread got that. They get the same benefit. And Dave's Bread is now all, you know, sold, but all over the country. And because they're one of my neighbors, I can tell you they're making plenty of money. They don't need an exemption on their equipment. And yet we gave an exemption on the equipment for Dave's Bread forever. And if we keep doing this, it's not going to get targeted. Once an area says, oh, we want this exemption for this business that's coming, they're going to be offering it to every other business, whether they're coming or just buying their replacement equipment. And meanwhile, we're not protecting education dollars. So I think that this should only go forward if there's an amendment that says education dollars will be exempt from abatement. That's the only way we protect the education that is actually our best economic development tool. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mary Stern.
Good morning, Chair Huff, members of the committee. My name is Mary Stern, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I apologize for being late. I had a sick child at home and was listening on the way in on my phone, and hope to apologize to Senator Boquist, but he is not here. I'll make sure I do that. The Association of Oregon Counties supports Senate Bill 1565, but with the amendments proposed by the assessors. We love the local option. We love the flexibility of this bill. But when the assessors came to us with concerns about how it would be administered, our board on Monday voted to only support with those amendments. And I appreciate the work Senator Boquist has put in. He came to our association and got their support early on. And I apologize for the lateness of our suggesting the changes. And I can answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Well, we'll continue to work, and I assume you and Senator Boquist will continue to talk.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 1565. Dr. Warner, is there any other business for us? We're going to meet tomorrow, and we will take Friday off.
So who did not testify?
And because of Senator
Bertschinger,
we're going to take Monday off too. So, but we will have a full slate on Tuesday to wrap up some of these. We are adjourned.
Oh, here's your other witness. Oh, here's your other witness.